Sunward Sky, Episode 2.10, Legacy. Despite the safety crew's best efforts, the attempt to drive off drones and other recording devices had proved almost completely futile. The machines swarmed all over the crash site of the pods. The emergency evacuation system of the Sunward Sky, once an out-of-the-way, poorly maintained system in the unknown arm of satellite maintenance for almost all global communications, was the single most streamed topic on every network. Entire data centers were flooded with imagery of each pod that had survived, taken from every angle, a palimpsest of video evidence. 1 million mechanical eyes broadcasting onto 20 billion retinas. Speculations arose about the number of people who were in each pod and what had happened. Anyone who had ever worked on a spacecraft or near one, or who had studied orbital mechanics for more than an afternoon, were dragged onto vid screens to be interviewed by pundits who breathlessly, earnestly, and inaccurately estimated the chain of events that had led to the crash. Animators worked overtime to get branded imagery of Sky Down, as it was being called, into their own newsreels. So long ignored except for historical images from space telescopes and long-range unmanned satellites, the story of space, once again, captured the imagination for all the wrong reasons. The night began to fall, and the drones could no longer effectively film the dark grey carcasses of the escape pods in the ink black of the choking sea. The horizon disappeared, and the majority of the operators cut back to their freshly curated imagery and hollow commentary. Rumors started circulating about the cause of the crash. Nobody directly involved with the Sunward Sky from Earth could be contacted, and those that did know what was going on were largely victims of the crash, and were either sick, infirm, or dead. Still, the numbers of views that were being driven to the vid feeds were indescribably high, and so the speculation continued, unabated. At some point, one of the drone operators had the thought to follow the rescue helicopters back to wherever they were taking survivors. There had been a lot of footage of the pods, the pod crashing, the remains of the pods bobbing in the ocean, but the rescue teams had been paying a particular level of attention to the sites as the survivors had been pulled out. As a result, there was a lot of before and after imagery of sealed pods and then rescue copters as they flew away, but precious little raw footage of the actual people that were being pulled from the wreckage. A lone drone, flying close to the water and matching as closely as possible the movements of the official rescue drones, followed a copter as it returned to the shore at a safe distance. The operator saw the copter land at a nondescript building not far inland. It was a concrete box warehouse, constructed in the bunker-lite architectural language of the brutalists of the mid-20th century, but it had been retrofitted. The main bulk of the building appeared unchanged, but outside there were a series of large battery arrays, a heat shield to the east and west over each of the windows, and what looked like a series of enormous water filters. Each one had a pan that faced the sky. They were filthy runoff tanks designed to expose the water to the UV of the sun. Supplementary systems had been hacked onto these too, with some of the additions being frantically installed by workers in sunsuits. The drone flew up, high enough to capture the entirety of the facility, and watched as the rescue copter waited for the doors at the end of the facility to open. The copter wove its way in, over the ruined tanks. The workers on the ground barely reacted, as they bootstrapped some kind of extra system onto the disused water filter. The drone operator waited, several hundred meters above the site. The camera tech allowed them to estimate the speed with which the door had opened to admit the copter, and they measured the entrance. Next, they calculated their altitude and figured out at what speed they would need to travel to get their drone through the doors in time before they closed. The copter maneuvered back out at the same moment as the doors did begin to close. The drone operator didn't waste any further time. The drone motors stopped, save for one, which gave a final kick to spin it upside down. The motors then restarted in reverse. The fans spun up at maximum RPM. They screamed a high-pitched whine that bore only a passing resemblance to the hum from the effort required to keep it in the air. The drone rocketed downward, accelerating through the air and punching against its own maximum speed. It shook, barely holding together, and the operator thousands of kilometers away swore as status indicator displays began to blink red on their dashboard. The door was barely open, with scant centimeters on either side of the drone's six fans as it blew through the aperture and into the warehouse beyond. It immediately made a braking maneuver at the same moment as it tried to right itself. Within the space was a cavernous landing pad and walls that rose almost to the roof that acted as baffles for the wind from the rescue copter fans. The operator swore loudly as the decelerating drone thunked against the inside wall, pushing itself up and away from the ground. The flashing red indicator for one of the wings went solid, and the response from the machine when it tried to turn to the right became sluggish. The drone popped up from just above the floor, pushing itself into the space above the baffle walls, and sped low across the makeshift drop-in ceilings that seemed to house some kind of office space or other, into the main hangar of the building. When it got into the main hangar, the drone operator nearly let go of his controls. The space was half filled with grimy tanks, musty light filtering through the windows where the sunshades weren't effective. Each tank was the size and shape of a standard bunk, glass-sided, bolted with steel sides and epoxy at the corners. They were stacked three levels high on gangways with umbilicals coming from the top and bottom. Several of them were cracked, with angry shards of glass surrounding the empty steel frames on the floor. Most simply lay empty, with days or years of grime built up inside them. The glass fronts, once clear, were caked and opalescent with filth. A scant few were filled with water. Whether water had been clean when it was pumped into the tanks was immaterial. It had absorbed the evidence of its disuse, becoming a dank, murky, choking colloidal mixture of whatever had been in the tank when it was empty. Visible in each of the few tanks that had been filled through the translucent muck were bodies floating. Each of them was stick thin, with a respirator obscuring their faces. From where the drone hovered, they looked like ghosts, held in thrall. The operator thumbed the controls and moved through towards the tanks. No wonder people were trying to clean the filters outside. The water looked noxious. The people in the tanks, from what could be seen through the camera, were limp, exhausted, and barely conscious. But it was far better than what was on the main floor. On the ground, at least a dozen similarly emaciated people were laying on the blackened concrete. They coughed and spluttered. A volunteer was walking between them with a breathing mask, pressing it onto their faces to allow the survivors to breathe more easily for a few scant seconds before they moved on to try to help the next person. On the gantry that held the tanks, two more volunteers with hoses were trying desperately to fill another, but were having to deal with a degraded and clogged hose. The water coming out of it was a sickly green-grey, and the asphyxiating survivors of the Sunward Skies crash were about to be plunged into the toxic liquid in an attempt to save them from the gravity that pressed their lungs closed. The drone operator blanched, but realized the opportunity that they had. They quickly began flying around the space, zooming in on the volunteers, the survivors, and the disarray and conditions in the abandoned rescue center. A security team came for the drone and tried to snatch it from the air, but the operator dodged and flew high into the air, capturing the entirety of the space for a few scant seconds before a young crew worker in high visibility orange came out and scrambled the imagery with a pointed attack from a digital EMP device. No more imagery came out of the abandoned and inhumane rescue center that day. But it didn't need to. The drone operator had streamed the entire journey through the space live, and thousands of people were linked into the stream. The pundits and media personalities, who for hours now had been rerunning the by now banal imagery of the pods falling, jumped onto the new imagery like wolves. They ripped the stream, cut it, replayed it, and spat it all over the world. The tale of the demise of the Sunward Sky turned quickly from that of an unfortunate disaster to one of practiced negligence. Still, the company that commissioned the ship to do its work remained silent. The media cycle continued, unabated, with grainy images of ghostly spaces in filthy survivalist conditions, was all that anyone needed seeing anywhere on any of the links that they followed. That is, until the sunward sky itself fell from space. The most amazing thing was how it broke up. A ship that size was only designed to return to Earth in a reverse liftoff. The aerodynamics, such as they were built so that they would baffle winds and correct course with thrusters in order to land back on the same landing pad it had left from several months prior. It wasn't supposed to re-enter the atmosphere any other manner. The sunward sky careened through the thickening air. Only hours earlier, the other 19 escape pods had left the ship in falling through the atmosphere, causing a small-scale simulacrum of a meteor shower that aligned with the shocking revelation of the shipmates' conditions, ensured that everyone in the world was watching when the sunward sky itself followed suit. The ship was maimed, and as it fell, the friction of the air around it heated the already blackened panels. A wave front appeared in front of the ship, a white mass of condensed air that heated up and eventually burst into flame. An orange-red tail began to stretch behind it. On the vid feeds, from every direction, the ship tore through the atmosphere. Its two remaining wings were still being rotated by the ship's centripetal grav system. The third was completely gone. When it entered the atmosphere, this caused the eccentric rotation that had been a nuisance in orbit to become catastrophic. In addition to the tail of red flame, a trail of debris, of broken steel members and conduits and ductwork and paneling, flew off into the void behind it. These too fell victim to the friction of gravity, causing sparks to fly behind the main tail of the ship as it tore itself to pieces in its final descent. After hours of feeds of six spaces and rehashed footage of crash pods, the burning blaze of glory was the crescendo that the media frenzy needed. A burning pyre, intercut with images of gaunt spaces, thrown far and wide into the brains of everyone, using the very satellites that the sunward sky was charged with upkeeping. Inside the ship, Meg was pressed into her crash couch. The space was rapidly heating up to the point where she could hardly bear it. Sweat ran down her head, and the oxygen outside the hull roared through the superstructure of the sunward sky, but not penetrating the safe room they were in. She could barely breathe. In a small part of her mind, she recognized that out there, in the atmosphere she'd dreaded falling back into, was what she'd need to get to as soon as possible when the ship finally hit the Earth. But for now, at the speed they were falling, the oxygen outside was as dangerous as the lack of it had been only minutes before. She gasped. Her tongue felt thick in her mouth. She knew that the fall would only take a minute or two once they broke atmosphere, but the roaring in her mind and all around her made it impossible to tell how much time had actually elapsed. It was an instant that held an eternity. She had been born into the terrifying roar surrounding her, and she would die here. White noise was all she knew, all she'd ever known. She breathed in again, but felt no satiation from it. Her mind was beginning to go more and more fuzzy, and the static seemed to match everything else in her existence. On and on it went, interminably. Until it didn't. The ship, or what remained of it, hit the ocean and decelerated from terminal velocity to near zero in an instant. Meg felt her ribs crack as she was thrown forward into the harnesses, and the roaring sound stopped. In its place was a sickening gurgle as the ship began to sink. Their position was at the front of the ship, and it had hit the water first, bearing the brunt of the impact. Meg panicked. They were running out of oxygen. The water in these areas wasn't deep, but if there was no part of the safety pod they were in that didn't protrude from the water, they wouldn't be able to do anything. They would have gotten all the way down to Earth, only to be starved of oxygen by a scant few meters of water. As the ship sank, it hit a cleft. A rock formation struck on its bow, sending a shockwave through the infrastructure. The ship lurched, and the nose began to tilt, until a small portion of the wing the trio were in broke the surface again, kicking into the air before the remaining thrusters of the aft of the ship sank into the sand and the ship came to a creaking halt. Meg was so oxygen-starved she could barely think straight, but she had no time. The room was tilted at a sharp angle, but she could see the broken and harsh clouds of the sky on one side of the thickened window near her. The window on the other side was underwater, peering out into the murk. She unstrapped herself, trying to ignore the pain in her chest. She pushed carefully, trying to fight the gravity that suddenly weighed on her. It was exhausting. She'd managed to maintain a semblance of muscle mass through a series of resistance bands in her cabin, but the exercise wasn't the same as the constant, clawing press of the entire world bearing down on you. As she moved to the window and the supply kit that was velcroed beneath it, the combination of thin air, pain, and gravity caused her heart to quicken. By the time she arrived at it, she was gasping for oxygen that wasn't there. She pulled open the cupboard. Inside, there was a drill. She picked it up and with shaking hands pressed it into the window. The hardened acrylic had at some point been a smooth, flawless feature of the sunward sky. But like all the aging parts of the ship, it was now stripped, scored, and scratched. She pressed the drill bit into the intersection of two score marks and triggered the drill. It made short work of the window, and despite everything else, a containment breach alarm went off inside the cabin as fresh, oxygen-rich air broke in. Putting the drill bit back, Meg pressed her mouth at the hole and sucked, feeling oxygen fill her lungs and finding the desperate, animal need to breathe escape from her. After her lungs were full, she breathed in. Getting a lungful and holding her breath, she drilled more holes. The drill hurt her arm, but she kept going, punching into the spacecraft she'd called home more and more and more until she physically couldn't lift the drill anymore. The pressure in the cabin was lower than that of the air outside. As a result, the fresher, better oxygenated air pressed itself into the space, mixing with the exhausted air of the ship. Meg was done. She staggered back to the couch, her legs flailing and wobbling beneath her, and she fell. She turned to look at her crewmates. Healy was gasping, slowly coming to, but unable to move. His muscles were too atrophied. Further away, she could see Alyssa. She wasn't moving. Half an hour later, the rescue team arrived. Keegan looked exhausted. He'd been helping ferry people back and forward for almost a full day now, and the itch behind his eyes was threatening to overwhelm his concentration. There was no easy access into the safety room from where they were. The ship was still mostly submerged. Keegan and another rescue worker had to cut into the bay next to the window where Mick had drilled the holes. The screeching sound of the saw against the hull of the spacecraft woke Meg up from the trance-like state she'd fallen into, and she watched as the crew cut their way in. After a hole had been cleared, she saw a man poke his head in. He turned to his colleagues, and she heard him yell, "Three stretchers!" before pulling himself into the cabin and making his unsteady way down to the sloping floor. Meg didn't remember much more of what happened on the way out. It was all shifting lights, a small team of people hefting her onto a stretcher, and then the cacophony of a copter and the sickening sensation of movement in a way she wasn't familiar with after the thrum of gravity she'd gotten used to on the sunward sky. Before long, the noise stopped, and Meg found herself laying on the ground in a warehouse full of filth. She didn't realize she was now laying in the very place that most of the media was trying desperately to access. As they lay her down, the young man who had picked her up and carried her out on the stretcher was walking past. He had a link going to someone and was talking quickly. "No other signs of life on the remains of the ship proper. They were there when we got there. Yes. No. No, just the two of them. We retrieved the third, but there were no life signs. Yeah. A stroke, I think. Yeah, I know." He kept walking, stocky and steady of foot, across the acrid floor of the warehouse. Meg began to shake, then sob as she realized what had happened. Alyssa, after managing to make her way through the entire ordeal of the sunward sky's orbit, had suffered a stroke on the way back into the atmosphere. It was a risk every time someone came back down, but there was no way to avoid it. She just got unlucky. Meg sobbed quietly to herself. They'd all got unlucky. Healy was laying next to her. With a great effort, she lifted herself up, and commando crawled her way over to him. An accretion of black, oily dust covered her flight suit as soon as she moved off the stretcher, and she could see the rest of the hangar. The tanks full of filthy water, with emaciated humans bobbing in them. The security crew of far too few people, walking around, administering oxygen to the other survivors who lay gasping on the floor. The people they skipped, not providing oxygen to them, as it was too late to do anything for their ailments. The immersion tanks were full, or not fit for human habitation. The emergency equipment was out of date, or badly maintained, or just broken. They didn't care about us up there, Meg thought. Why did I think it was going to be different down here? She used her elbows to get to Healy. His eyes were open, but just barely. Slits, peering out from a craggy face, opening into the world that had let his life become this. Healy, she said. He grunted softly in return. Did you hear what that man just said? No. Everything is just... it's too loud. And I can't... breathe. I know. I'm so sorry. Meg dropped her voice to something barely above a whisper, then leaned down to him and said, Alyssa didn't make it. Silence. There was silence. And then Healy, with great effort, sat up. The carabiners, rather than the safety devices and softly clinking adornments to his suit, were now a millstone around the body that had degraded to the point where even sitting up was a huge effort. He sighed heavily, and then turned and crawled on his hands and knees to Alyssa. When he got there, he stayed almost stock still, just for a moment. He was above the young scientist's body, staring at her closed eyelids. For a moment, Meg thought he was going to bend down to kiss her forehead, but he didn't. Instead, she watched his lips begin to move. He spoke softly, so softly that Meg couldn't hear more than the deepness of his voice and the sensation of his Scottish brogue. It seemed to be a prayer of some sort. Once he was done, it was obvious what even that small amount had taken out of him. His face, usually haggard, was seamed with sweat and pale. Before he collapsed, Meg saw him reach down and briefly hold Alyssa's hand, and watched him mutter, "Thank you." As he pulled his hand away, she saw something in it. A bottle of some kind. He slipped it into his breast pocket, and then his strength gave out. He rolled onto his back on the floor, gasping and broken. The sweat on his face was a death mask, and his skin had gone so pale it was almost grey. "Hey," Meg said, trying to get the attention of the scant few staff on the floor of the hangar. "Help! He needs help!" One of the staff heard her, and rushed over with an oxygen bottle and a respirator. She pressed it to his face, and after a minute Healy stopped hyperventilating. His features, still pale, began to harden. There was a rage beneath them, and a dark look in his eyes that had replaced the emptiness Alyssa had seen when they first met. He still couldn't speak, was still having trouble breathing, but he began to say something into the respirator, softly and urgently, repeating it like a mantra, until the staff member noticed. "What?" she said, but Healy wasn't able to speak any louder. He kept repeating it, over and over, urgently, until the staff member took the respirator off and leaned down to press her ear closer to his head. "Project Blackout. Find Brett. Find Elise. Find War. It was them. They know what happened. Project Blackout. Find Brett. Find Elise. It was them. They know what happened." The tank was filthy. Grains of muck and grime swam on her skin, and the water itself felt like an oil slick being slowly rubbed against her body. The world outside, terror, the space she'd never been able to properly inhabit ever again, was a broken mess of grey-white liquid smoke. Elise knew she stank. She couldn't smell, with the respirator on her head and cut off from the rest of her body, but the filthy water and broken down filtration system was recycling the same oily, sweaty, aged water in and out of the tank repeatedly, miring her in gunk that she knew would take forever to get out, if she ever got out. She didn't remember how she'd got here, but she'd been one of the few deemed in such bad condition for the tank to be considered an option. Her lungs now felt lighter, and she was alert due to the oxygen-rich feed she had coming through her respirator. It was eerily quiet. Below, on the ground, she could see the blurred outlines of the other survivors. She was glad she wasn't down there. As she floated, a rhythmic thud began to thrum through the water, and a small team of people came walking along the gangway toward her. They stopped outside the tank. One of them looked like one of the rescue staff. The other three were security. They surrounded her and stood imposingly. Hers was the only tank that was receiving such treatment that she could see. The rescue staff member knocked on the glass. The noise reverberated through Elise's skull, and she turned to face him. He was blurred, but the tablet screen he held up explained everything. Brett hadn't needed any special assistance. He'd been on Earth several years prior to the launch of the Sunward Sky, and so his muscles, while degraded, weren't suffering the same degree of palsy as the rest of the crew. He could still stand easily enough. He could walk. He was one of the lucky ones. His eyes cast angrily around the hangar in an anteroom cum office just outside where the rest of the survivors lay on the floor. Typical Terrans, he thought. Too much hard work to clear a space up, to make it habitable for the spaces in the event that something actually happened. Just let it fall into disarray. Let the expendables rot and lay on the floor as the fruits of their labor let the rest of the world continue to work. He wished he could say he was surprised. Brett? The voice came from behind him. He turned. The Terran that had picked him up from the life pod, he wasn't going to say who saved him, was standing in the doorway, along with several security guards. Brett felt his heart quicken. What is it? He said flatly. Does the term Project Blackout mean anything to you? Brett wheeled around from the small group of Terrans and looked out into the hangar. It took him a second. They were a fair distance away, but he spotted him from the ridiculous carabiners on his flight suit. Healy. The fucker had survived the crash. He took off at a flat run, away from the guards and out of the door into the hangar. His leg strength wasn't what it used to be, and he was slowing down. The security was behind him, and gaining fast. But he'd reach Healy first, the traitor. He jumped over the prone bodies of the other survivors and stumbled slightly, blinded with rage. He was going to kill him. It didn't matter what happened now. He was going to kill him, and he was going to make sure it hurt before the Terran security team got to him. He wasn't going to let the old Scottish prick get away with it. 5 meters. There was a woman lying face up on the ground. He just had to get over her. He jumped. Something hit him in the leg, and he pivoted mid-air, crying out in pain. He landed awkwardly, sprawling on the ground next to Healy, and felt a sharp stabbing pain in the wrist that he'd put out on the ground in a vain attempt to catch his fall. He cried out, and turned to see what had happened. He recognized the woman. It was Meg. She'd seen him running, and had stuck her hand up to trip him on the way. She, too, was crying out. The force of his running body had broken her forearm, and she was holding onto it, but looking at Brett with a satisfied kind of vengeance in her eyes. Ignoring the pain in his left wrist, Brett hoisted himself up and staggered to where Healy lay, and landed a single furious blow onto the old man's right cheek. There was a deep cracking noise as the brittle cheekbone fractured, and a gash split across Healy's face. Brett fell furiously onto him, winding up to hit him again. The second blow broke his jaw, and several teeth flew out, yellow-white stars against the grimy black ground. Brett didn't land a third punch. The security forces caught up, and two of them tackled him onto the ground. The third was pulling out a set of cuffs from his belt. Brett tried to fight back, but despite being in better condition than most of the rest of the crew, he was still no match for a pair of well-built Terrans.
"You fucker,"
Brett cried, struggling futilely as he was cuffed and dragged away.
"After all the work we did, after all we achieved, you fucker, you sellout fuck."
Healy was barely conscious, laying on the ground in a rapidly growing pool of his own blood. Despite this, he managed to smile. It was a grotesque mockery of a grin that split his features, and he stared up at the Project Blackout member, being dragged away at the same time as another set of security guards walked across the gangway above, where unbeknownst to him, Elise floated in grime.
"You can't achieve anything," Healy managed to mumble, "if all you want to do is destroy. That's what you never understood."
Brett's cries of rage echoed across the hangar as the security team dragged him out and Healy fell into unconsciousness as the medical team rushed over. The drone that had flown into the hangar and broken the story of the treatment of the spacefarers had been the first stone which had started the landslide. Over the following months, a series of investigations were completed that looked into the treatment of people that were taken into spacecraft such as the Sunward Sky, and the working conditions and expectations that they were held to when they signed up. Entire rackets and corporate rings that were tasked with finding drug addicts, homeless, lonely and disenfranchised people to serve as indentured slaves on the maintenance ships above the orbit of the Earth were uncovered, and a series of companies were charged with human trafficking and unfair work conditions. The media had a frenzy, and the Sunward Sky became a catch-call for the revolution in spacefarer rights. The silence of the corporation that ran the Sunward Sky during the disaster, along with the footage of the inhumane conditions the rescue workers and survivors had to work with, was used as an indictment of the corporation that had been neglecting to run the Sunward Sky for years. The company was dissolved, as were several others. A number of directors were jailed. Several were found dead. Curiously, these deaths usually occurred in cities where known crew members had family, but this was ruled as coincidental by investigators, and the deaths were marked as suicides. Healy made it out of the hospital after 12 weeks. Once he was out, his assistance in describing his role aboard the Sunward Sky was used to understand and identify the location of the Scarabs, the parasitic machines that were to be used to hijack the communication systems. Project Blackout was destroyed. One by one, the Scarabs were found, hitching a ride on GPS and communication satellites, burrowing into their controls and still waiting to scramble them when an order that was never coming was given. Each was carefully extricated from its platform and sent down to Earth. The fruits of Project Blackout came to illuminate the night sky in a series of metallic meteorite showers. Brett and Elise were interrogated. Elise never broke. Her fury at what her life aboard the spacecraft had done to her body had left her unable to betray Project Blackout, the one thing she felt she had agency over in her adult life. Brett, on the other hand, for all his bravado and bluster, broke down in the face of repeated interrogations. He'd managed to glean enough information simply by his proximity to others in the project on the ground to know where the Scarabs were manufactured. He knew one of the Earthside coordinators, and from there, Project Blackout's operational base was routed, broken, and dismantled. Brett, Elise, and all the other members were jailed. The Sunward Sky Protocol was enacted and signed into law, a special edict that described the length of time and the length of respite workers could reasonably manage in low-gravity environments to try and limit the effects of the space palsy that had led to the discontent among the would-be terrorists of the Sunward Sky. Nearly a year later, Healy and Meg were in a courtroom. It wasn't the first time. Over the previous months, they'd each grown used to sitting, waiting, and wear wheelchairs for their turn to give evidence, or depositions, or lend their weight in some other way to the proceedings. It was due to their testimony that the majority of the crew aboard the Sunward Sky had been exonerated. They'd each given statements to the governing bodies to argue for further rights for space travellers. Their own wheelchair-bound condition was shown as evidence of the cruelty of the Spacefarer Corporation's practices, and they would continue to be held as an example for years to come. Despite that, there was one question that hadn't been answered after all the suing and counter-suing and parliamentary hearings and media frenzy. What had happened aboard the Sunward Sky? Healy looked at Meg as the other members of the hearing chamber shambled in. They were both in the front and center of the room, in the wheelchairs they'd been assigned almost a year prior. Healy reached into his pocket and thumbed the container he found there. Alyssa's medication. The tub was empty now, but for a chalky residue. It had a cracked lid from where it had been broken on impact, and Healy found himself running the top of his fingernail over the imperfection in the surface. It was all he had left of her. He'd been too far gone after the attack from Brett in the hangar to do anything about it, and he wasn't able to forgive himself for being hospital-bound when she, along with all the others who had never made it out alive from the crash, were honored in a funeral a few weeks later. Because as far as he was concerned, they were only here because of her. The young woman who had come aboard to build something, to take a risk on herself for the sake of everyone, for people she didn't know, and even for people who wished her harm. Alyssa, the one who had raised the alarm on the Scarabs, who had convinced him that doing something hard to make a stranger's life better was worth so much more than working to make the people he'd hated lives worse. Alyssa the med student, the spacer, the Terran. The chamber had filled up, and the announcements were coming over the public address system. He was used to it now, a bunch of pomp and ceremony he'd never been afforded before in his life. Camera drones whizzed past, and large static cameras adorned the corners of the walls. Everywhere he looked, there were the unreal black eyes, behind which he knew there were millions upon millions of people waiting to hear the testimony of Meg and himself. Meg was going to tell the technical details he wasn't across. How they'd managed to stay keel up, how the crash had actually happened, what it was that the Scarabs were actually doing, all that sort of stuff. The camera lights all turned on. The black glass faces winked with light, and red LEDs indicated that they were live. Reaching into another pocket, he pulled a smaller vial. This one was unbroken, and still full of similar but more robustly made chalky pills as the ones he'd got from Alyssa. He winked at Meg, and she smirked at him. Then he popped out one of the pills and put it in his mouth, in full view of the camera, and washed it down with the glass of water on his desk. Less than a minute later, his name was called, and the pitter-patter and chit-chat in the room went silent. An orderly approached and began to move the microphone down to a level where he could reach it from his wheelchair, but Healy waved him off. Gripping the side of his wheelchair with both hands, he kicked the footstands away and placed both feet flat on the ground. He pressed, carefully at first, then with more confidence, and he heard nothing but the rustle of his clothes as he stood up. He shook slightly. It was still an effort, but he wasn't going to do this from the chair. He reached into his pocket, felt for the small container with the cracked lid. Alyssa's pills. He pulled it out and placed it carefully on the evidence table in front of him. The microphone whined slightly as he adjusted it, staring keenly into the dark eyes of the cameras and of everyone who was watching him from around the world, using the very communication system he'd spent a lifetime maintaining. He looked one more time at Meg, and she nodded. He cleared his throat and began to speak.
That was the final episode of Sunward Sky. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed it. I am stoked that you've followed me on this journey. If you did like it, please give it a rating and or a review on whatever site you're listening to it on. And also, if you look into the description below, you'll find a Linktree link. It has details for all of my social media to follow me on there, as well as links to my other work, such as my novellas and my articles on Medium. There's also a Ko-fi link, and if you really enjoyed this, I'd very much appreciate a donation of whatever amount you can afford. Absolutely no pressure if you can't, though. I'm not sure what the future holds at this stage, but I will be writing in and releasing more stories in some form in the future. Whatever I do, I hope to see you there. I've been Henry Nielsen, and this has been Sunward Sky. Thanks for listening.